Chapter 25. Trout was stretched out on the cramped bunk with his hands behind his head when he sensed that a barely audible vibration had replaced the low-end rumble of the sub's engines. He felt a soft jolt as if the submarine had come to a cushioned stop. Then there was silence. Gamay, who was dozing off on the top bunk, said, "What was that?" "I think we've docked," Trout said. Prying his long body off the tight sleeping platform, Trout got up and pressed his ear to the door. He heard nothing, and he surmised that the sub had reached its destination. Minutes later, two armed guards unlocked the cabin door and told them to get moving. Sandy was waiting in the corridor under the watchful eyes of a second pair of guards. She had been moved to another cabin, and it was the first time they had seen the Alvin's pilot since McLean's visit. Trout gave Sandy a wink of reassurance, and she greeted him with a nervous smile. Sandy was holding up well, but Trout wasn't surprised at her resilience. Anyone who piloted a deep submergence vehicle on a regular basis might be frightened, but not intimidated. With guards in front and behind, they climbed several levels to a hatchway that took them out onto the submarine's deck, forward of the conning tower. The sub was around 400 feet long. It was anchored in a cavernous submarine pen that had a high, arched roof. At the far end of the chamber, an intricate system of conveyor belts and ladder hoists disappeared into the wall. The guards prodded them across a gangway. McLean was waiting on the dock. "Good day, my fellow passengers," the chemist said with a genial smile. "Follow me, if you will, as we enter the next phase of our adventure." McLean led the way to a large freight elevator. As the door closed, he glanced at his watch and his smile vanished. "You've got about 32 seconds to talk," he said. "I only need 2 seconds to ask you where we are," Trout said. "I don't know where it is, but I suspect from the climate and the terrain that it's in the North Sea or Scandinavia. Maybe even Scotland." He checked his watch again. "Time's up." The elevator door hissed open and they stepped out into a small room. The armed guard who was waiting for them barked into his walkie-talkie, then ushered them outside to a waiting minibus. The guard motioned for them to climb aboard, and then he followed, sitting in the back where he could keep an eye on the passengers. Before the guard pulled the window blinds down, Trout caught a glimpse of a long, narrow cove far below the edge of the road. After a ride of about 20 minutes over unpaved roads, the bus stopped and the guard ordered them off. They were in a complex of buildings surrounded by high barbed wire fence topped with electrical transformers. There were guards everywhere, and the complex was disturbingly reminiscent of a concentration camp. The guard pointed toward a squat concrete building about the size of a warehouse. To get to it, they had to pass through more barbed wire. As they neared the building's entrance, an unearthly scream from inside the structure pierced the air. A chorus of shrieking howls followed. Sandy's face registered her alarm. "Is this a zoo?" she said. "I suppose you could say so," McLean said. His grim smile was not especially reassuring. "But you'll find creatures here that the London Zoo never dreamed existed." "I don't understand," Gamay said.
"You will."
Trout grabbed the chemist by the sleeve. "Please don't play games with us."
"Sorry at the poor attempts at humor. I've been through this little orientation one too many times, and it's starting to get to me. Try not to be too alarmed at what you're about to see. The little dog and pony show is not meant to harm you, only to scare you into submission."
Trout gave him a faint smile.
"You don't know how good that makes us feel, Dr. McLean."
McLean raised a bushy eyebrow.
"I can see that you're not without a bleak sense of humor yourself."
"It's my Yankee upbringing. Our long, crummy winters discourage a sunny view of the world."
"Good," McLean said. "You'll need every bit of pessimism you can summon if you're to survive this hellhole." "Welcome to the strange island of Dr. Moreau," he said, referring to the fictional story of the mad scientist who transformed men into beasts.
The guard had opened the double steel security doors, and the stench that poured from inside the building overpowered all thoughts. The foul odor was a minor annoyance compared with the sounds and sights in the large room. The walls were lined with cages occupied by man-like beasts that clawed and bit at the bars. The cages held 25 to 30 of the creatures. They stood on two legs and wore filthy rags and were stooped over in a half-crouch. Their long, stringy white hair and beards obscured much of their faces, but there were glimpses of wizened and wrinkled features, the skin covered with dark age spots. Their mouths were open in a feral howl of rage and anger, displaying ragged and stained teeth. Their eyes were blood red and glowed with a terrifying luminosity. Sandy had had enough. In a display of common sense, she bolted for the door, only to be blocked by a tall man dressed in army camouflage. He easily caught her by the arm and led her back into the building. He had a large nose, sharply tapered chin, and a leering mouth filled with gold teeth. A black beret was perched rakishly on his head. His presence had a strange effect on the caged creatures. They went silent at his arrival and retreated to the back of their cages. "Good day, Dr. McLean," he said, speaking in a European accent. He eyed the trouts, letting his gaze linger on Gamay. "These are our newest recruits." "They are experts in our fields of study," McLean said. There was a flurry of activity at the door. "What luck. You and our new guests arrived at feeding time." A crew of guards entered, pushing a dolly stacked high with rat traps, the humane type that catches rodents without killing them. The guards unloaded the dolly, carried the traps and their squealing occupants to the cages, and released the rats. Eyes glittering like rubies, the white-haired creatures had returned to the front of the cages. They must have been familiar with the drill because they were ready when the rats darted out of the traps. They pounced on the unfortunate rodents with the speed of panthers. Growling ferociously, they ripped the rats to pieces and devoured them with all the gusto of a gourmet in a 5-star restaurant. Sandy ran for the door again. This time, the man wearing the beret stood aside and let her go, roaring with laughter. Gamay was tempted to follow, but she knew she would rip the man's arm off if he laid a hand on her. "The young lady evidently does not appreciate our recycling system. We control our rat infestation and feed our guests at the same time." Turning to McLean, he said, "I hope you have told our guests what a lovely place this is."
"You are far more eloquent and persuasive than I could ever be, Colonel," McLean said.
"That is true," the man said.
He turned to face Trout.
"I am Colonel Strega, the commander of this laboratory facility. The filthy devils you see enjoying their fine meals were once men like you. If you and the ladies do not do as you are told, we can make you into one of these fine-mannered fellows. Or we can feed you to them. It will all be according to my mood and generosity. The rules here are simple. You will work without complaint, and in return you will be allowed to live. Do you understand?"
Trout was trying his best to ignore the gnawing and belching that issued from the cages.
"I understand, Colonel, and I'll pass your message along to my weak-stomached friend."
Strega stared at Trout with his wolfish yellow eyes as if trying to memorize his face. Then he gave Gamay a 14-carat smile, clicked his heels, wheeled about, and headed for the door. The guards prodded the Trouts out of the building, although they didn't need any persuasion. Strega was getting into a Mercedes convertible. Sandy was leaning against the building, vomiting. Gamay went over and put her arm around the Alvin's pilot.
"Sorry about all that," McLean said.
"Strega insists on this orientation for newcomers. It's guaranteed to scare the pants off them."
"It scared more than that off me," Sandy said. "Next time I'll know to wear a diaper."
McLean sighed.
"We've all had a hard day. Let's get you settled in your quarters. After you've had a chance to shower and change, we'll get together for a drink at my place."
The bus went another half mile, passing through more barbed and electrified fence, finally stopping at a complex laid out with a large round-roofed building surrounded by small, flat-roofed structures.
"That's the lab where we'll be working," McLean said.
He pointed to a building set off by itself.
"That's Strega's place. The guards have their quarters right next door. The cottages are for scientific staff. They look like bunkers, but you'll find them quite comfortable."
The guard ordered everyone off the bus and pointed the Trouts and Sandy to a pair of adjoining cottages. McLean's place was next door. Trout and Gamay went to their quarters, basically one room with an iron bed, a small table and chair, and a bathroom. It was Spartan, but clean. They shed their clothes and took long, hot showers. Trout shaved with the dull disposable razor left for him. Two lime-colored one-piece coveralls lay neatly folded on the bed. They had no desire to get into a prison uniform, but their own clothes had smelled vile even before they visited the animal house. Trout's coverall was somewhat short in the sleeves and legs, but not uncomfortable. The bow tie didn't match, but he wore it anyhow. Gamay would have looked glamorous even in sackcloth. They went next door to get Sandy, but she was sleeping and they decided not to awaken her. McLean welcomed them to his cottage, which was identical to the others except for its well-stocked bar. He insisted that they call him Mac. Then he poured three glasses of Scotch whiskey and took the bottle with him when they went outside. The air was cool, but not uncomfortable. "I think my quarters may be bugged," McLean explained. "Colonel Strega is a resourceful man." "I'm not sure I care for his sense of humor," Gamay said. "He's better known for his other qualities. The World Court would like to talk to him in regard to some mass graves in Bosnia. How's your drink?" "Fine. We couldn't do better at Club Med," she said. "When I get too depressed, I pretend I'm on vacation in an out-of-the-way resort," McLean said. "At the resorts I visited, lunch wasn't delivered in rat traps," Trout said. There was an awkward silence, which was broken by Gamay. What, or who were those loathsome creatures in those cages? McLean took his time answering. "Those were mistakes. As a fellow scientist, you'll understand when we say you have to be more specific," Trout said. "Sorry. Maybe I had better start at the beginning." McLean poured more whiskey into his glass, took a hearty swallow, and stared into space with a far-off look in his eyes. "It seems so long ago, but it's only been 3 years since I was hired by a small research company outside of Paris to work with enzymes, the proteins that are produced by living cells. We were interested in the role that enzymes play in the aging process. Our company had only limited resources, so we were ecstatic when a large conglomerate absorbed our lab." "Who was behind this conglomerate?" Trout asked. "We didn't know, and we didn't care. It didn't even have a name. We received substantial raises. We were promised greater funding and resources. We didn't mind when new conditions were imposed."
"What sort of conditions?"
"Under our new management, guards constantly watched us. Men in lab coats and suits, but guards nonetheless. Our movements were restricted. We lived in housing close to the lab. Company vehicles picked us up every morning and night. Those with families were allowed visitors from time to time, but all of us were warned of the secrecy of our work. We even signed contracts agreeing to the strict rules, but you have to understand, we were giddy. We were on a quest for the true Philosopher's Stone."
"I thought you were a chemist, not an alchemist," Gamay said.
"As I recall, the Philosopher's Stone was a substance that could transform base metals like lead into silver or gold." McLean nodded. "That's a common misconception. Many ancients believed that the stone was the legendary elixir of life. If you mixed this wonderful substance with wine, the solution could heal wounds, restore youth, and prolong life. That's the stone we were looking for."
"The quest for immortality," Trout mused. "It might have been easier to turn lead into gold." A faint smile crossed McLean's lips. "Many times during our research, I had the same thought. I often pondered the impossibility of the task we had set ourselves."
"You're not the first to fail in that quest," Trout said.
"Oh no, Dr. Trout. You misunderstand. We didn't fail."
"Hold on, Mac. You're saying the elixir of life exists?"
"Yes. We discovered it at the bottom of the sea in the hydrothermal vents of the Lost City."
They stared at McLean,
wondering if the insanity of this island had turned the Scotsman into a madman.
I've been poking my proboscis into sea mud for a long time, Trout said after a moment. I've yet to discover anything that resembles the Fountain of Youth.
Gemme shook her head. You'll have to excuse my skepticism. As a marine biologist, I'm more familiar than Paul with the vents, and to be honest, I don't have a clue what you're talking about.
McLean's blue eyes sparkled with amusement. You know more than you think you do, lass. Please explain why scientists around the world are excited about the microbes that have been found around the vents.
That's easy, Gemay said with a shrug of her shoulders. Those bacteria are like nothing that's ever been found before. They're living fossils. The conditions in the Lost City are similar to those that existed at the dawn of life on Earth. If you figure out how life evolved around the vents, you can see how it could have started on Earth or even other planets.
Exactly right. My work started with a simple premise. If you had something involved in the creation of life, maybe it could extend life as well. Our company had access to samples taken on earlier expeditions to the Lost City. The enzyme these microbes produced was the key.
In what way?
Every living creature on Earth is programmed for one task, to reproduce itself as many times as possible. Once its job is done, it becomes redundant. Thus, all organisms have a built-in self-destruct gene that dispatches them to make way for future generations. In human beings, sometimes the gene is activated prematurely, and you have Werner's progeria, where an 8-year-old child looks like an 80-year-old. We reasoned that if this gene can be switched on, it could be switched off, with the result that you slow aging.
How would you test something like that? Trout said.
You'd have to give it to test subjects and wait decades to see if they lived longer than your control group.
That's a good point.
There would be patent issues as well. Your patent could expire before you got your product on the market. But this enzyme not only switches the gene off, it serves as a super antioxidant, disarming free radicals. Not only can it retard the chemical processes that lead to aging, it can restore youth as well.
The Philosopher's Stone?
Yes. Now you understand.
You actually succeeded in doing this, Trout said.
Yes, in lab animals. We took mice that were senior citizens by human standards and restored their youth dramatically.
How dramatically?
We had mice whose age in human years was 90 and reduced it to 45.
You're saying you reversed the animal's age in half?
Absolutely. Muscle tone, bone structure, energy levels, reproductive capacity. The mice were even more surprised by it than we were.
That's a remarkable achievement, Gamay said,
but human beings are a lot more complicated than mice.
Yes, he said with a sigh.
We know that now.
Gamay picked up on McLean's unspoken message.
You experimented on human beings, didn't you? Not my original team. It would have been years before we conducted trials involving humans. We would have done it under the most stringent of conditions.
He gulped his drink as if it could wash away unpleasant memories.
My team presented its preliminary findings and we heard nothing for a while. Then we were informed that the team was being disbanded, the lab broken up. It was all quite civilized. A handshake and a smile. We even received bonuses. Sometime later, while he was clearing off his computer files, a colleague came across a videotape detailing human experiments. They were being conducted on an island somewhere.
Trout pointed to the ground at their feet. Here?
A reasonable assumption, wouldn't you say? McLean said.
What happened next?
We made a second fatal mistake in underestimating the ruthlessness of these people. We went back to the company as a group and demanded that they stop. We were told that the subjects were all volunteers and that it was none of our business anymore. We threatened to go public with the information. They asked us to wait. Within a week, members of my former team began to have fatal accidents. Hit and run. Fires. Electrocuted by unwise use of home appliances and tools. A few healthy men had heart attacks. 21 in all. Trout let out a low whistle.
You think they were murdered?
I know they were murdered.
Did the police suspect foul play? Gemma asked.
Yes, in a few cases, but they could never prove anything. My colleagues had gone home to a number of different countries, and as I said, we were working in secret.
Yet you survived, she said.
Sheer luck. I was away on an archaeological dig. Hobby of mine. When I came home, I found a message from a colleague, since murdered, warning me my life was in danger. I ran off to Greece, but my former employers tracked me down and brought me here.
Why didn't they kill you too?
McLean laughed without humor. They wanted me to lead a reconstituted research team. Seems they were too smart for their britches. After they killed off the original team, flaws began to surface in the formula. It was inevitable with research this complex. You saw their mistakes dancing around in their cages a little while ago.
You're saying that this youth elixir created those snarling beasts, Trout said.
McLean smiled. We told the fools that more work was needed. The enzyme has a different effect on humans. We're complicated creatures, as you say. There was a delicate balance involved. In the wrong mix, the chemical simply killed the subject. In others, it triggered progeria. With those poor brutes you saw, the substance reached back in time and brought out the aggressive traits that served our ancestors well when they were reptiles or apes. Don't let their appearance deceive you. They still have human intelligence, as Strega learned.
What do you mean?
There are two types of creatures. The alphas were part of the original experiment, which I'm told started many years ago. The betas were created in the most recent round of experimentation. Not long ago, a number of them managed to escape. Apparently, they were led by the alphas. They constructed a crude raft and landed on another island, where they killed a number of people. Strega hunted them down and brought them back. He subjected some of the alphas to the most awful tortures before killing them in view of others as a lesson.
If there's so much trouble, why do they keep them around? Gemma said.
Apparently, our employers believe they have some value. A bit like us. Disposable tools. The latest test subjects were illegal immigrants from poor countries who thought they were going to Europe or America for jobs and a better life.
Trout's jaw hardened. That's one of the most monstrous schemes I've ever heard of. One thing I can't figure. Why did these goons hijack the Alvin and kidnap us?
The enzyme has a short shelf life. They built the sub so the enzyme can be extracted as soon as it is harvested. It's separated from the microbes. Once it is stabilized, the submarine transports the finished product here for further research and development. They knew about your expedition. They must have been afraid their undersea mining project would be discovered. By chance, you were within minutes of discovering it.
It wasn't chance at all. We were looking for the source of Gorgon weed, Gemma said.
Now it's my turn to be puzzled. What is Gorgon weed?
It's a mutated form of a common alga, Gemma said.
It's been causing havoc around the world.
The source of this mutation was traced back to the Lost City. We were trying to pinpoint its exact cause. We didn't advertise this part of the expedition because we didn't want to panic people. The situation is far worse than anyone has said in public.
In what way?
Gemma said, if the weed is allowed to proliferate, the oceans would become nothing but huge, soggy mats of vegetation. Ocean commerce would be impossible. Ports would be closed. Most species of fish would die, creating a huge disruption of the food chain that is bound to affect land production. The weather created by normal ocean cycles would become chaotic. Governments will fall. There will be disease and famine. Millions of people would die.
Dear God, I was afraid something like that could happen. What do you mean? Gamay said.
The microbes were perfectly harmless in their natural habitat. There was always the possibility that they would migrate once we disturbed their habitat. They have evidently mutated the genes of higher organisms.
Can it be reversed?
There is a good chance we could apply the work we're doing now to the solution.
Do you think Colonel Strega would be open to a suggestion that we direct our energies towards saving the world from a Gorgonweed infestation? Trout said.
McLean laughed. Colonel Strega believes this camp is the world, and that he is God.
All the more reason to escape, Trout said.
These people that kidnapped us must have known that a massive search would be launched for the Alvin, Gamay said.
McLean looked into his empty glass, and then his eyes met hers.
According to Strega, the situation would be taken care of. He didn't go into details, but a number of the mutants were removed from the island not long ago. I think they had something to do with the plan.
No details? McLean shook his head.
Trout forced himself to deal with the problem at hand.
You said you were brought back here to reconstitute a scientific team, he said.
Yes. There are 6 other unfortunate souls who were lured here, like the immigrants, with promises of work. You'll meet them at dinner. Our employer took great pains to make sure they were single people with little or no family attachments.
How long do we have?
We have all known that we will be killed as soon as we extract the pure elixir. We've dragged our heels as much as we can while showing some progress. It's been a delicate balance. A shipment of the elixir went out while we were on the sub.
What does that mean for us?
We'll become redundant after the formula gets to its destination and our employers see if it will work.
Will it?
McLean nodded.
Oh, yes.
The initial results will be quite swift and dramatic. Once Strega gets the word, he will start throwing us to the animals one by one.
He shook his head.
I'm afraid I rescued you only to bring you into a situation with no hope.
Trout rose from his chair and gazed around the camp, thinking that the rugged beauty of the island was out of place with the horrors he had seen.
Any ideas? He said.
I think it would be helpful if Mac told us everything he knows about this place, Gamay said.
Every detail, no matter how silly or stupid it seems. If you're still thinking of escape, forget it, McLean said bleakly. There's no way.
Gamay glanced at her husband.
There's always a way, she said with a smile.
We just don't know what it is.